Brad, I had the most amazing discussion about Superman this weekend with a six-year-old that I wanted to share with you. Are you ready for some Superman fun facts?
I am ready. I'm ready for this.
Okay, so I was trying to teach the six-year-old. They're like, how come Superman never has a beard? And I said, aha, here is a fact that I know. Here is a stupid Silver Age Superman fact that I know. I who never read Superman. Do you know how Superman shaves? Do you remember this?
No, I do not know this.
So Superman takes a broken piece of his ship and he bounces his eye beams off the ship and shaves his chin with his own eye beams.
Are you serious? This is part of canon?
This is canon. Oh boy, there's a lot to talk about there. But yes, this is canon that no human razor, no human blade could cut even a whisper of a hair on Superman's chin. He's so strong. What a guy.
That's true. But he's too manly to be shaved.
He has to bounce his own dang eye, like a chump. He's got to bounce his own eye beams off and shave his chin with his eye beams. But here's where the conversation took an amazing turn. The six-year-old had an idea that no comic writer has ever had. And I was like, you're a genius. The six-year-old goes, hey, why didn't they just make a razor out of kryptonite? And I was like, oh my God, that blows my mind. A kryptonite razor.
I love the way he is thinking. That is fantastic.
The dummies had it staring in front of them the whole time. Superman could just... although, it probably would make him want to throw up every time he's shaving his beard off. But it's certainly easier than bouncing your eye beams off like a dummy off of your own broken-ass ship to shave your chin.
It does seem like kind of a really rinky-dink way to shave.
Yeah, it's very convoluted. I mean, imagine you before your coffee... and you're blinking, and you're trying to aim your eye beams at your chin or that little spot right under your nose. You're trying to get that with your eye beams, and unfortunately, you singe all your nose hairs. And you're like, "Well, that's a Tuesday. All right, great." Cut to a six-year-old walks in. Well, why don't they just use a kryptonite blade? Boom!
Well, you know, that reminds me of the one piece of Superman canon that I do remember that is right in that same category. You have to hand it to these writers in the Silver Age of comics, particularly DC. They had no holds barred, especially when it came to Superman, because at that point, they had it completely in their heads that he was the alpha top superhero. There was nothing he couldn't do. That's where we got stuff like super ventriloquism and not only x-ray vision but telescopic vision, and you know, he could do everything. And at one point somebody threw that same old saw at them of, well, you know, how is it that Lois Lane can't figure out that Clark Kent is Superman? Just because he puts those glasses on, he still looks like Superman. He's still going to have these bulging muscles. And they actually wrote it into Superman canon that his glasses have special Kryptonian technology that hypnotizes anyone who's looking at him.
No, they didn't, did they? Oh, God.
So that's why the glasses are a perfect disguise, is because they have Kryptonian hypnosis attached to it.
God bless America. That's the dumb...
Isn't that wonderful?
Well, using my Kryptonian glasses, no one will know that I am Clark Kent and Superman.
Isn't that... I think that was great. He's got Kryptonian glasses that hypnotize, and that's why the glasses work. It's perfect writing.
That is a great demonstration of writing your way out of a hole. It's just like, no, I don't know. It's like waving a hand as he says it. How about Kryptonian technology in the glasses? How about that?
That works. That sounds good. That's lunch.
That's good, Jimmy. Let's go get some bagels. All right, great. Everybody, that's 10. We're going to take 10. My favorite, though, is the Legion of Super Pets. Did you ever hear about this? Did you ever read about this?
Oh, yeah. I remember the Legion of Super Pets.
Superman had a freaking super horse. It's the dumbest thing ever. He had a super cat named Streaky the Super Cat. Streaky!
And a super monkey?
There was a Beppo, the super monkey.
Yep.
But it's the cat I want to focus on. Streaky the Super Cat? What is that, a sexual aggressor? Like, why do they call him Streaky?
Streaky.
Is he lactose intolerant? Why are they calling him Streaky?
Oh, God. God.
Streaky the Super Cat.
Streaky the Super Cat.
Whoa. Put down that ice cream, Streaky. No. Oh, that's his kryptonite.
No. Now I need my kryptonite mop.
Oh, Streaky has his own weaknesses. Lex Luthor's off to the side. He's like, ha ha ha, Superman, I've got you tied up with a chain of kryptonite. And Streaky, you're sitting in a bowl of ice cream. Oh.
You better hope there's no super-powered horses around here to get you out of this.
And then Comet was... Comet the super horse.
Oh, was it Comet?
Yeah, Beppo the vaguely racist named monkey.
Beppo, that was one of the Marx brothers, wasn't it?
Was it? Was Beppo a Marx brother?
It was Groucho, Chico, and Beppo, wasn't it?
You might be right. And then there was Proddy, but I don't remember what Proddy was.
Proddy?
Prody? Proddy? I don't know.
Trying to think of what we're missing. Maybe it's a super, like a parakeet or something, like a cockatiel. Proddy sounds like a cockatiel.
Although nothing's going to beat Streaky the Super Cat. Just like Superman comes home from stopping Lex Luthor. The apartment is just a mess. He's like, damn it, Streaky, did you get into the milk again? Ah, son of a bitch.
Hit the litter box for once, you stupid cat.
God, you're a super cat, for God's sakes. Act like it.
It's the one cat he wanted to give to Bizarro.
Bizarro, take care of cat. Oh, God, no, Bizarro, give cat back. Bizarro make terrible choice.
Bizarro regret life decisions.
Bizarro give cat cheese pizza. No, Bizarro make huge error. All right. Well, on that note, friends, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Streaky, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. Let's start off with the Eisner Awards, the 2019 Eisner Awards. The call for submissions is out. And the deadline, again, is March 15th, 2019, for everybody who is not previously familiar with that. As is always the case, there are 48 categories for the Eisners. Including best original mopping in the hallway of a DC Comics office. I just joke because the Eisners have 1,000 categories. It's like if you don't fit into a category in the Eisners, there is trouble because there's something for everybody. But I do want to direct our specific audience to a fun fact that Gary over at Fleen.com, FLEEN.com, noticed, and I think it's worth pointing out. The best digital comic category, which previously was sort of, I guess, an ebook category, wouldn't you say, Brad?
Yes, yes,
like
it was.
It was basically designed for e-publishing ebooks and that sort of stuff. Now it has sort of a parenthetical after it. So it says best digital comic, that's the category. And then it just says published online in 2018. So I think there is an argument to be made that that could include short form webcomics, which previously did not have a category in the Eisners. So,
big complaint for years and years is that they didn't really have a place for short form webcomics to go.
Yeah, because they did have best webcomic, and you would think like, oh, great, best webcomic, good category. But it was specifically best long form webcomic published online in the previous year. And so you would only have, a certain percentage of webcomics that could submit to that. So now best digital comic, again, I'm grabbing the paper again, best digital comic seems to indicate that it could be an ebook, but it could also be a short form webcomic. So if you weren't previously going to submit thinking, oh, well, once again, the Eisners don't have a category for me, they do now. So there we go.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And by the way, we should probably mention, because this happens, there's a lot of imposter syndrome that goes on around this time of year. If you have any question as to whether you should enter these contests, I'll answer it for you. Yes, you're a professional. If you're doing this and publishing it on the web, you're a professional. You, and by the way, Yeah, my attitude on this is always the same. Let them tell you no. There's nothing worse than you telling you no. Let them tell you no. If you're not qualified, fine, you'll find out. Or more likely, you'll never find out because you'll never hear back, and that's okay too. But don't take yourself out of the running because of your own imposter syndrome. If you think that you want to put something in for the Eisners or for the Harveys or the Ringos or what am I forgetting here? The Hugos?
Hugos,
you've got to be nominated. But put Ignatz, that's the one I keep forgetting. Put your hat in the ring and give it a shot. Oh, the NCS Awards, same deal. Yep. Although I think the deadline for that is passed. But just in general. Put yourself in for these awards when these nominations come out and you're in the position to self-nominate. Don't even think twice. I had to talk Dave into nominating because he was like, nah, I kind of feel weird about self-nominating and then doing a large amount of self-nominating, right? Remember that conversation? I'm like, hell no.
Well, first of all, Brad is right. He did have to talk me into it. But here's the context of it. I was absolutely going to submit to the Eisners. But
yeah,
I fit into a lot of categories, and I was kind of feeling like an asshole for submitting to so many categories. But Brad's like, Brad's best point was, let them say no. Like, don't you, you don't decide. Just put it in there, put it in consideration, and then let them say, this is not really a short story. So, because here's the context of why I was feeling like a jerk. So I was going to submit my Tales of the Drive short stories for best short story, Sheldon for best publication for kids. I have the Pugs book from last year, Drive for the best publication for teens, the Pug book for the best humor publication, best graphic album, new material, I was going to do for Drive again. Best digital comic would be SheldonComics.com, the website version. Best web comic, the long form stories, would be DriveComic.com. That's the website version of Drive. Best writer artist, which in parentheses says cartoonist, I was going to submit myself. And then for best coloring, I was going to submit my colorist, Beth. And so I said to Brad, I just feel like an asshole. That's so many categories. And Brad's like, shut up. You're doing good work. Submit it. Don't be a dummy. Don't run home and tell your mother.
Because who cares, by the way? One person is going to see that list, and that's going to be Jackie Estrada. And, you know, she sees, I guarantee you, much, much worse. She sees people, remember the old Gemstone Comics days where those Donald Duck comics would get all these Harvey Awards, and it would get introduced for all of these different categories. People have seen much worse than that list you just ran down for yourself. So yeah, I wouldn't give that a second thought.
Well, let's talk about one thing, Brad, because I had to hire for two positions for Mattel Toys when I was back there, and I've hired since, I guess, three or four assistants for working in my studio in the years since. And I want to tell you that. Take an extra moment to make your submission packet clear, concise, and easy to read. Tell them exactly what you need to be submitting for, and do it in a polite and professional manner. Like sometimes I feel like these judges probably get submissions like, here's my stuff, just vomit it out and like make it organized. I mean, they are reviewing literally everything in comics for 2018, these poor five people. So make it easy for them. And God sakes, just spend an extra 20 minutes writing a concise cover letter that says, here are the categories I'm submitting for. Bullet point, bullet point, bullet point. Here are the titles for which those submissions exist. Bullet point, bullet point, bullet point. Thank you very much. If you need any further information, here's my phone number. Here's my email. Here's my websites. Here's the, anything that you would need to do for an award submission. Just take a minute and format it for them, because it'll make their life better and it'll make your chances better, more importantly.
And I think the important word there is concise. This is no time to get cute. This is no time to prove how precious you can be. Just think about, put yourself in those judges' shoes. They've got a mountain of stuff to wade through. They're going to do the first two or three passes and look for any excuse they possibly can to take something off of that pile. Don't give them an excuse. Make it easy. Make it concise. Take any bit of guesswork out of it. And for crying out loud, don't be that person that feels they need to show how cute they can be, how creative they can be in their cover letter, and just end up obscuring the facts that they're trying to see. So, yeah.
And to Brad's earlier point about imposter syndrome, I just want you to be careful as you submit. don't let any insecure, hesitant language trickle into your awards consideration submission. So don't say anything like, here are my submissions. Page 22 is not as great as page 23, 24, 25. So don't put too much into that. The character development, I got better as I went. The line art, I got better as I went. Like, they know all the things that that an artist would say in terms of self-hating. So don't put it into their minds that this work is anything less than great. Submit the title, make it concise, make it clear. Bam, you're out. Don't have to explain anything away. Don't give them pages of like explanation of backstory or anything like that. These are all pros. God, no. They know what they're getting. Let them do the work, but make it concise and easy for them. Brad, wouldn't you say that's a good button on that one?
I think that's a good place to leave that, especially because we've got a really, really interesting topic coming up that has been actually all over social media for the last couple of weeks, and I've been dying to talk about it with you. So let's get right into it.
Let's dive right into it. So this, Brad and I have noticed a trend in the last, what would you say, Brad, maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks? I think it came around with people doing the year-end consideration of their careers and finding something short, coming up short, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was exactly what happened.
So here's the big progenitor of this conversation. Nate Powell, the amazing artist on March, put out a tweet where he kind of on a whiteboard, or maybe it's a piece of paper, listed out how little a graphic novelist could live on from a book advance. So he put out a mm-hmm. sample number, and this could be low for some people, high for some people, but it's a good sample. On a $30,000 book advance, $4,500 go to the agent. So you're left with $25,500 for the entire run of the book, one third of which you'll get upon the signing of the contract, one third on the completion and the turning in of the project, and one third on the publication. And the short form of all of this is that he breaks down further numbers, but it basically works out to over a 2-year graphic novel production period, you're working on $455 a month, right? And so he was saying there's a reason why graphic novelists are struggling so much and have to produce so much work and are working at a breakneck speed and hurting their bodies. And it's because a single contract, a $30,000 advance and full payment for a book is kind of not a lot not to live on, right? And then a few weeks later, we got word from a UK cartoonist who was talking about how she was having trouble working off of the £10,000 a year that she's living on or making from her comics from traditional publishing.
Yeah, I've seen that one go around a lot, too. That one really took off on Facebook.
Yeah, and then there's been a couple other cartoonists. But the underpinning of all of this and the thing that Brad and I, because first of all, it's always good. More sharing is always better than less. So kudos to all the cartoonists for sharing where they're coming from. But an undercurrent that Brad and I started talking about that has us concerned is, because we've seen it before with newspapers and comic strips, is this feeling like, well, Brad, if print doesn't work, then I just don't know what other possibilities there could be. This is obviously the only way to have done it. So I did my best and now I'm quitting or some version of that, you know?
Yeah.
Brad, you chime in because you had a good thought about this as we were starting to talk about this.
There's a lot to get into here. First thing that I want to make sure that I note is that there's been a lot of reaction to this throughout comics. And one of there's one that you're going to get pretty clearly from Dave and I, who come from a very certain standpoint in comics. But there was another reaction from John Backdurf. He goes by Durf in his comics. His comic that probably received the most wide recognition was My Friend Dahmer, about his friendship in high school with Jeffrey Dahmer. And I actually know Durf personally. He and I kind of did a quasi-job sharing thing at the Akron Beacon Journal. We actually shared a desk for a few years or so. And he came up. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a really nice guy, and super, super skillful cartoonist. But he took to social media to say, he referenced specifically the Nate Powell tweet, and he said, just so you guys don't get super scared about this, I've been doing this since, the mid-90s, and I haven't had a day job since 98, and I've always had a very comfortable life, and it is possible to do this, especially in a print publishing situation. If you want to see his actual verbiage, follow him on Twitter. But he basically said, it certainly is not easy, but it's possible to make a very comfortable living in comics. My bigger problem with this is that it kind of, for me, my opinion, came from a standpoint of, well, this isn't working for me, therefore nothing works, the system's broken, and I'm done. And that seemed to kind of be the upshot of both of these tweets that got so much engagement over the last few weeks, right? It's like, well, system is broken. And in my opinion, and again, it's just, and I don't know everything that's going on in these two creators' lives. So I want you to understand right off the bat, I am not criticizing them specifically so much as expressing that when I've been in that situation, and I've been in that situation a few times over the last going on 20 years, my answer wasn't to say, well, the system's broken, therefore nothing can be done. Every time I've come up against that, I've said the system's broken, and therefore I'm going to do this other system, or I'm going to adapt to this other system, or very often I'm going to create a new system altogether.
Right.
In other words, my at no point have I ever accepted helplessness.
Yeah.
Out of this, and right.
Yeah, to reemphasize, it's not about these specific cartoonists, because both of them love cartooning. And in Nate's case, he's making a good career of it as multiple Eisner winner, an amazing
cartoonist.
Absolutely. And so this is not in any way, but it's more a discussion of how, because Brad and I experienced this with newspaper comic strips, where they go, well, there's only one way to do it, and the one way is breaking apart, so I guess I gave it my old college try. Or an alternate to that is, well, the system is breaking compared to what it used to be, but I'll just keep beating my head up against the wall with this system, trying to make it work, right?
Yeah.
And so we've seen versions of this among a myriad of cartoonists. And what Brad and I are trying to say is that part of the way to build a career online is to not, like, there's almost a, when you are rigid, when you are stuck to a path of what true comics are, what a quote, real career looks like, and it's only through publishing with a real publisher, a big publisher, a small yeah. publisher, any publisher, then what you're doing is you're setting yourself up for a system that is creaking on its tracks to not work for you. And that there is such benefit to your career to going, okay, no, I'm gonna incorporate multiple income streams, all in cartooning. Yeah. I'm gonna control more of my career. And so that's what Brad and I are getting at, is that we often find that people are like, well, I tried that Brad and Dave's way, and that doesn't work for me either. And we're saying, that's fine. Don't necessarily assume that we're pushing our way of making a career on you. But here's what we are trying to push on you, is don't accept any one path as being the one true path of comics. There are multiple ways, all of which could be made to work or hodgepodge to click together with different pieces. And so if you throw up your hands and say, well, print doesn't work anymore, these advances are unlivable wages, or, well, book publishers can't make a cartoonist career anymore, and you throw your hands up and you quit, Brad and I are here as friends saying, no, there is Patreon, there is Kickstarter, there are direct sales, there's Etsy, there's also there's PayPal, there's a billion ways to bring in income, all of which can add up to, frankly, a very comfortable living if you do it right.
Right.
And so you don't have to accept poverty level wages, and you don't have to accept the remaining advances that publishers can afford for comics, because there are, frankly, better ways now. And it's not necessarily the ways we do it. Just look for other ways.
Yeah. And here's the other thing. When so here's the deal. I can picture somebody listening to this podcast and they're like, yeah, that's great for you guys. You guys came up through the web. You guys have been doing this every day, and it's natural to you. But I don't feel like I can learn Kickstarter. I don't feel like I can learn Patreon, right? The answer to that is that you can. Number one, there's a lot of things we've got to dissect if you're feeling like what we're talking about is impossible for you. Number one, it's not. If you're a cartoonist, step number one, if you're a cartoonist, you're using your brain, in my opinion, to the absolute top level of brain use. If you're doing words and images, if you've got the intelligence to make something like that work, you are not a dummy. You are able to figure out lots of stuff, including math, taxes, business, all of this other stuff, crowdfunding, you can do this. And of course, it's going to feel alien and scary. And there are lots of good resources out there to help you through this. And there are lots of people, if you reach out to them, will be more than happy to share a little time with you and say, okay, here's what I know. Here's what you might be able to do. Reach out to some of your colleagues who might be walking a different path. You'll be surprised at how open they are to giving you a helping hand. And number two, you got into this business to be creative.
Yeah.
And we've said this on this show so many times. I know I have. How dare you back away from a creativity challenge that involves your business? Okay, so this isn't working. Time to get creative. Time to think outside of the box. It's what you do. It's your strength. It's your superpower. Go out there. And so if this whole idea of getting an advance for your publishing isn't working, time to apply that creativity to finding some way that works. You should be champing at the bit to apply that creativity, in my opinion. And by the way, I'm not downplaying. I know it's scary. And if you've got kids, it's scarier yet. Or if you've got a spouse that you're supporting or a partner that depends on you, or just if you've got your own version of Streaky the Super Cat. You know, I get it. I get it. No. I understand it. None of this is as flippant as we're making it sound on some stupid podcast. We get it. There's real life issues.
Absolutely.
But don't back down from this challenge. There's different ways, and it doesn't have to, like Dave said, doesn't have to be our way. But for crying out loud, use your creativity and find that way.
Yeah.
Right?
You know what? I realized the way that I said it before was more meandering. So I want to clarify this because.
Yeah,
the offensiveness to Brad and I here is not failure. Brad and I fail all the time, and we are going to fail more.
Oh, God, yeah.
And failure is part of being an artist. And you pick yourself up, and you dust yourself off, and you get back to work, right? So the offensiveness is not failure. The offensiveness is the rigidity that some people face the publishing world when they say, well, you know, there's only one way to build a career, and it's through a publisher, and it's broken, and so I'm giving up. And so that's the offensiveness of it. When you're so rigid as to say there's only one path to be a cartoonist and it's broken, therefore I give up, even though I'm a good cartoonist.
Yeah.
So I want you, I don't want you to have to feel like you have to do it Brad and Dave's way, but you just can't say there's only one way to build a career and it's broken.
Right.
Because you see from the evidence all around you that people are making a go of it other ways. Don't just think you have to go through Abrams or Image or DC or Marvel or Boom, right? You don't have to do it that way. Because frankly, the people and friends that I have that are doing it that way, it's not great. You know, it's not mm-hmm. what you thought it was going to be when you were 14. Take control of your own career. And will it be harder? Yes. But will it also be more rewarding and maybe more fun because you have the creativity and the control that a lot of cartoonists wish they had? Yes, that's also true. And will it be scary? Absolutely. Brad and I recognize that. Brad and I are still scared every day about the thing. I'm still scared about prepping my taxes for this year, and I've been doing it for 20 years, you know? So like every stage is scary. We're all still high schoolers stumbling our way through adult life, but you know, you'll figure it out. And again, as Brad and I always preach, it's baby steps. You know, don't tackle the world in one go. Take a little bit of a risk at once in a controlled manner. But just don't throw up your hands and say, well, system's broken, I'm done, or system's broken, but it's the only way to do it. So here I go, keep banging my head up against this wall.
Yeah.
Find the flexibility and the creativity to look out for different paths to make a career in cartooning.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics. All right, Dave, it's time for a question from one of our Patreon backers. You ready for this?
I'm ready, my friend. Let's do it.
All right. Hey, this is coming in from Chris Halbeck, who's a good friend of both of ours. He does some really great comics. I follow him on Instagram all the time. Maxim Humble and all kinds of great stuff. So do check out Chris if you get a chance. And his question is, how do you deal with someone accusing you for stealing a joke from another comic, movie, TV show, etc.? And part two, conversely, how do you deal with someone accusing another cartoonist with stealing a joke from you? So the topic here is joke theft. How do you deal with somebody accusing the theft of a joke? Either you stole it or it was stolen from you. I ask you, Dave Kellett.
Wow. Okay. So which one to tackle first? Okay. So I'm going to tackle the kinder one first, because I think it will help inform the first one. Okay.
Okay.
So how do I react when someone says, hey, Dave, this site over here, they stole your joke. And look at this. This is the exact same joke. And what I do is I tell both. First of all, I thank the person because they're clearly trying to help me. Right. It's a
their heart's in the right place.
Heart's in the right place. They're trying to help me. They're saying, Dave, this is... And so I thank them because, frankly, there will be the occasional person who is genuinely stealing it and profiting off it. And so action does need to be taken in those cases. But
yeah,
for most cartoonists on cartoonists, what I almost invariably say is, well, great minds think alike.
This is going to be a short conversation, I think.
Yeah, because... who am I to say that they did not individually come up with that idea in the same way that I did, in the same way that two people on opposing ends of Europe came up with calculus at the same time, you know?
Yes.
So we are living in a zeitgeist, and zeitgeist, just as a reminder, is it's a spirit or it's a mood of an age, right? And so things are looked at a certain way, certain moods are felt, there are pretty set and predefined reactions to most patterns in life because you're living in a sort of culturally defined zeitgeist. And so the way one humorist in Los Angeles might react to something is kind of similar to the way one humorist in Philadelphia is reacting to something. So both get the same input. We were both raised in similar cultures, and therefore the joke that we create is kind of similar. So if you gave Brad five stimuli and me five stimuli and said, go, I bet you that if we both came up with 10 joke pitches, a lot of them would be pretty similar, you know?
Yeah.
Both because Brad and I shared the same culture. We live in a broader zeitgeist that's similar, and we are of a similar like-minded people. But what I'm getting at is I try to be very generous about it because, A, jokes are dime a dozen, and also, who cares? It's fine. It's always funny, too, to see someone's execution on the same joke. Now, that's with the assumption that everything is cool. There will be the occasional company, and they usually pop up through the same damn places like Redbubble or 9Gag. What's that? Yeah, Zazzle. And they try to take my punchlines and put them on a t-shirt. Now, am I losing a few thousand dollars to sales that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to generate? Absolutely. Do I want to spend my life worried about it? Not really. So if it's clear that I need to send a cease and desist through a lawyer, if it's a big enough thing, I've done that maybe once or twice. But frankly, nothing comes of it. And it's, why am I stewing in that anger anyway? Life is short.
Right.
And so I don't even know for a fact if they're making a ton of money. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But anyway, when it's a cartoonist coming up with a joke and someone's saying, Dave, they stole your joke, usually I just say, great minds think alike. And then I get back to work on tomorrow's comic, you know?
Yep.
That's the ultimate thing. Because if I want to stew on, like, damn that Brad Geiger, he stole my joke, then what am I doing in that moment? I'm living in the past, and I'm only making myself depressed on something that happened in the past. Whereas if I go, good for Brad, he had the same idea, I guess that happens. And then I start working on tomorrow. So that's how I handle when someone comes to me and accuses someone else of joke theft. Now, Brad, having heard that, do you want to tackle what you do when someone comes to you and says, Brad, you stole this joke from an Australian movie from 1964?
You've got nothing you can do because logically it's impossible to prove a negative. In other words, I'm never going to prove that I didn't do something. And so at that point, you take my social media strategy and you say, listen, I didn't do what you're accusing me to do. This is a great minds think alike situation. And if they don't take a very obvious and honest and heartfelt kind of genuine explanation, drop it. There's no way you're ever going to convince this person that you didn't steal a joke. All you can do is tell them genuinely that you didn't, and then don't add fuel to the flame. Don't offer them more engagement points. don't get involved with it. There's literally nothing you can do after that. After you've honestly said, I didn't do what you're telling me, saying that I did. Let it drop. Let it drop. Because any engagement that you offer after that is just going to keep the thing rolling.
Right. And frankly, there are people, to kind of semi-quote Batman, there are people that just kind of like to watch the world burn. And so because their creativity is failing them, the way they channel their creativity is to break other things. You know what I mean? Like, look what I made. I broke this table. Look what I made. I broke this glass.
I made a broken table.
Yeah, I made, and literally that's a form of how wars start and how fights start, because it's like, look what I can break, you know? That's how you're channeling your creativity. It's in the negative. Whenever someone's like, Dave, you stole this idea. That was so and nothing that I can say can assuage them, because I'm like, look, I had that idea as I was falling asleep. I had talked to my wife and we were joking around and I came up with this idea. I wrote it down. I did the cartoon. And I've never read this 1964 Bulgarian novel that you're referring to, you know? But because their creativity is in destroying things, they're like, no, it has to be that you stole it. There's no way two people can come up with the same idea. Blah, 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 blah. And you're like, all right, well, congratulations on your happy life and I wish you well. You know, that's all you can do.
Have you ever been, switching the story, have you ever been accused seriously of joke theft?
Well, not in any malevolent way, but I have had people go, hey, this cartoon, this is literally the same idea as Blankety Blank. And then I will click over and look at Blankety Blank and be like, oh, shit, yeah, that is absolutely, we came up with the same idea. Holy crap. You know what? This is a great one. There were people, I was doing Anatomy of Animals, and there is a cartoonist in the UK, and she's doing... frankly, a very similar version to that. And neither she nor I knew we had never heard of each other. And we don't know who came up with it first. So I just said, nah, all right, go with God. And she did the same. And so that was that. But there were people outside like, you stole from her. She stole from you. You stole from her. And meanwhile, she and I are like, that's fine. I have never heard of you. And she's like, I've never heard of you. Great. All right. Well, let's keep going. And so
that was nice that you were both able to just kind of let it go.
Well, what's the point? Like, what are you
exactly?
What are you gonna do? Like, as Brad has made a point very well in the past that ideas are dime a dozen, and it's execution that matters. And so her execution was totally different, and frankly, adorable. And my execution was totally different, and frankly, different. So why? Neither one of us having heard the other one, it's not a weird thing that both of us, having grown up with biology books, would come up with this anatomy of something idea. And then apply it with humor. You know, it's not a completely 100%, ex nihilo idea. It came from something, and we both had biology books growing up, and so I can see how we both came up with the same idea. But anyway, it's fine. But now, Brad, who has ever accused you of joke theft? Or it doesn't matter who. Do you remember?
Listen, in order to be accused of theft, first you have to do something that's worthy of stealing, and I don't think I've ever done a whole lot that was worthy of stealing, but I have been accused very seriously of joke theft once, and it turned into quite a terse little conversation. So right at the same time that I took the buyout from the newspaper and I was going full-time, I was really kind of giddy with excitement over the fact that I was going to have a little bit more time. I wasn't going to be rushing into work every day. I was going to have a little bit more agency over my time. And my wife, for Father's Day, got me lessons in stand-up comedy. It was like 3 weekends in a row. And it was something that I always wanted to experience. And she got me these stand-up comedy lessons. So, of course, I went to work building a monologue, right? And one of the things that I used was this concept of my wife and I lying in bed and her saying, listen, I want you to know, if she says to me, if I ever die, I want you to know that you can get remarried. In fact, she says, I want you to get remarried. And we lie there and she says, do you think you'd get remarried after if I die? And I said, no, not at all. And all of a sudden it became, why aren't you going to get remarried? And I said, I don't want to get remarried. And it went on from there, right? And so this whole thing, the joke setup was that she was telling me it's okay. And I'm like, I never want to get married. I don't want to ever be married again, which is, of course, you know, hyperbole because my wife listens to the show and exaggeration. But I had built it into a really kind of neat little construct, right? So right. I did this on stage at the class, and this teacher comes to me and he says, listen, we need to talk. And I said, okay. And he says, you stole my joke. And I said, I couldn't have stole your joke. I've never seen you perform in my life. I didn't steal your joke. He says, well, a lot of my stuff is on YouTube. I said, oh, I'll check it out sometime. He says, well, you must have already because you stole my joke. And I said, I really didn't. I said, oh, what is your joke? And he told me his joke. And of course, it was the same premise of would you get married after I died? But then he took it in a direction of the concept was he already had somebody in mind who he was going to marry after she died. And that was the punchline.
Right.
And I'm like, these are two completely, it uses the same setup. It uses the same premise, but they're totally different jokes. And he says, no, you can't do that. You can't use my premise. he's the instructor. So I'm like, well, listen, it's not the strongest thing I've got out there. I'll just take it out. It's not a big deal. He says, yeah, you better. Joke theft is a real serious thing. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'm probably never going to devote the kind of time I'd have to devote to be a competent stand-up. You really have nothing to fear from me. This is something I'm doing for fun on Sunday afternoons. But if it makes a difference to you, I will never tell that joke again. And he's like, well, you better not. It was bizarre. The amount of ownership he took over the premise, not even the punchline, the premise of this concept
right.
that, by the way, I've heard from about a dozen other comedians ever since. I think I've heard that set up from Tim Allen and a dozen other people.
Right.
But yeah, it was bizarre.
Well, this is perfectly illustrative of Brad's idea that the ideas are dime a dozen. It's execution that is important. And here's what I mean. What huge percentage of adults get married now? Still probably in the majority at some point in their life, right? Even though the divorce rate's around 50%.
Yeah.
So you've got that group, right? You have a second idea that's also worked into this. Someone's going to die, right? So that's the second part of this joke equation. Well, guess what? 100% of people are going to die. So that's also a gigantic portion of the population, right? So now you combine those two numbers. And then you talk about the expressing of anxiety as a couple falls asleep. Well, every married couple that's ever existed expresses their anxieties to one another as they're falling asleep, right? You talk it out. And so that's also a huge number. So that joke concept, the iterations of that are in the multitude because, of course, there's a million people having that identical conversation, right? And so the execution is where it matters. And this comedian took it one way and Brad took it the other way. And by the way, neither one of them had heard or seen the other one do it firsthand. That's why I say great minds think alike, right? Because both of them said, there's humor in this moment. If I die, will you marry again? One person takes it one way, one person takes it the other way. And so you can choose to get mad about it or you can choose to go, oh, look at that. Well, we did it different ways. but now the flip side to all this, and this is worth having a conversation over, is that where things get tricky is a joke idea, a punchline, dime a dozen, right?
Right.
Concepts are a little bit trickier. If I next week started doing a comic that's about a corporation run by and for supervillains, Brad would be like, well, now hold on a second.
That's a little close.
Ideas might be a dime a dozen, but concepts, you know, the overall structure and underpinning ideas of a thing. Like if I'm like, so Brad, it's about this young farm boy and he's on a planet and he meets kind of this old wizard who tells him that he's got to go fight this evil kingdom, right? And only he can fly this spaceship, but it's called the X-Craft, right? And you're like, that's Star Wars, Dave. You're just redoing Star Wars.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is, and then there's also the third equation, which is that some ideas are monetizable. And so those are the ones you have to be careful of. Like, I'm sure Casey Green with the This Is Fine comic had to do a lot of C&Ds with people. And he probably still has to do a lot of C&Ds because they're like, yep, I'm just going to take that idea and put it on a coffee mug, right? So that you absolutely have to protect. But if it's a gag a day, or if it's a simple throwaway line and someone happens to have used it somewhere in some other part of the world, my advice for your general health is to shrug it off. If money starts to get involved, or if it's a core idea that's really unique to you, maybe don't shrug it off. Maybe reach out to them and be like, hey, I couldn't help but notice that you're doing XYZ. And then if that goes nowhere, maybe you'll then have to do a C&D. But your first reaction should be like, oh, look at that. Well, great minds. That's my advice. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's not worth getting all torn up about. And my own thought is that the only thing somebody can steal from you is something you did yesterday. The real power that you present as a creator is the thing you're going to do tomorrow. So I do agree in protecting your copyright. I do agree in sending out cease and desists when it's necessary. All of that stuff, I totally get it. But allowing it to consume you, and we've seen this already in a couple of different cases where it's almost like it's the only thing this person can talk about is this concept that, you know, well, that was my idea. That was my, and every time you see them talking on social media, they're bringing that thing up again. They can't let it go. It's their white whale. And it's like, oh man, I get it. That sucked what happened. I totally get it. Move on. You got to go to the next thing. You got to get to your tomorrow These people really are going to succeed in bringing you down.
Right, because they're telling themselves, I only had one good idea and somebody stole it. And so now it's a life of bitterness, you know?
Yeah.
I like the way that you said that, though. That was a very Susan McTaggart way of saying it, of like they can only steal from you what's in the past. No one can take from you what you create in the future.
It's been a while since we've heard from Susan McTaggart. How's she doing?
Brad, you remember Susan McTaggart and her famous book. Hi, everybody. I'm Susan McTaggart, life coach and worldwide author. You remember my new book. Have you seen my new book? Impossible is Only an Opinion.
And McTaggart, Miss McTaggart. Yes, yes. I was thinking, I was going to go deep sea diving without any equipment. And but I thought it might be impossible to breathe underwater. But should I be worried about this?
Well, Brad, I want you to know from my new book that impossible is only an opinion, that impossibility is only an opinion. Start diving, my friend. You can do it. Reach for the stars. Hi, I'm Susan McTaggart. That's my new book. Hey, well done. That was great. I didn't know you could do that sound effect. You genuinely got a childlike, like, wee, look at what Brad's doing.
Theater of the mind.
Brad, I was carried there. I was at the ocean with you. That was great.
Well, I'm glad.
How did you do? Oh, now I see how you did it.
I went up and down with my finger. So I think we put a good button on that one. Dave, do you want to do another topic here while we got some time?
Yeah, well, let's do one more. Let me read it to you on this one, okay? So this, Bradley, this one comes in as one of our Patreon questions. It comes from our buddy Jay Lark, and it says, Brad and Dave, what guidelines would you recommend for an exclamation point use in comic dialogues? Sometimes I wonder if the mark gets overused. In texting and messaging apps, ending a sentence with just a period is sometimes interpreted as overly terse. And to compensate, we use exclamation points all over to convey happiness and enthusiasm, even if the situation doesn't necessarily warrant it. Do you see the same thing happening in modern comics? Bradley J. Geiger, I turn that question over to you, my friend.
This is such a good question. We've got a lot of different types of writing that are going to collide here. In other words, I'm a little bit hesitant in letting social media norms bleed over into comics, because then there's a whole deal with all caps lettering that I've got to deal with. And I'm still a big proponent of all caps lettering, despite what it means on social media. So I'm not sure I want to go down that road. Although I'm also always kind of watching how my work is getting responded to. And at some point, it might not be my choice.
You know what's great? But as a friend, I can sense that you're fighting your grandpa on this, wanting to come out in this conversation already.
Yeah.
That it's,
yeah.
I really don't like the way these shoes fit. Why are socks always made to tight at the ankle? I don't like it. I'm Brad Geiger.
Well, no, but I guess this, here's the thing I'm trying to say is each different mediums are going to have different norms for how they handle this. And just because you see this thing happening in social media doesn't necessarily mean it's going to come over into comics, because then you go over into prose and you get a good writing instructor who talking about a novel, and they'll tell you you get to use an exclamation point 3 times in your entire life. Right? They come, you've never heard that advice before?
No.
I've had writing instructors say that exact thing. You can use an exclamation point 3 times in your entire life. They really, you better really be excited before you use an exclamation point for a prose instructor. So I think there's different norms for different mediums. And that being said, I don't have a huge problem with the fact that exclamation points are a little bit overused, because I can see the writer in a comic trying to generate a certain amount of enthusiasm. I agree, you can go too far. I'll tell you what I'm more worried about than a percentage of exclamation points. I get more upset when I see multiple exclamation points used on one sentence. I think one exclamation point is enough.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 or 3 if somebody's being murdered in front of you. That is much more troublesome to me than a high percentage of exclamation points used throughout your writing. I'm more worried about multiples on one sentence. What do you think about that?
Well, I'll tell you, I was just sitting here trying to feed these pigeons, and these people keep walking by and scaring my pigeons. I'm Brad Geiger. Why won't people let me feed these pigeons?
I just like doing Grandpa Geiger every once in a while. Brad Geiger 60 years from now.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, I actually do have opinions on these things, but I probably thought about it too much.
Why are postage stamps always going higher? It's the same mailman. I'm Brad Geiger. All right, so
why do people look at me funny when I refer to those adhesive stamps as previously licked stamps?
I'm Brad Geiger. I like ending all of that with "I'm Brad Geiger." Like, you know when you're doing a bad impression?
Hey, I'm gonna do my Robert Redford. Hello there, Susan. It's me, Robert Redford.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm Ronald Reagan. Well,
it's like letting the words. It's such a tip of the cap of, well, I'm doing a shitty impression.
I'm Brad Geiger.
Anyway, so I agree with you that the bigger danger is the encroaching use of 2 and 3 exclamation points, which it immediately infantilizes the point. You know, it just makes it feel like a 9-year-old was doing the writing. Unless,
yes,
frankly, a better way to do it, if you want to show, like to Brad's example, someone's being murdered in front of a character in the comic, right? Better than three exclamation points, show, don't tell. Make it a terrifying moment rather than just having the exclamation points do all the work. Or, barring that, let the font or the lettering do the work rather than having the exclamation points do the work. Or let your coloring or your tonalities in that panel. It's shock, so it's bright yellow with manga streaks coming out of it. Or it's super dark with blood gashes coming. What I'm saying is, let the comic do the work rather than trying to put the heavy load on 3 exclamation points, right?
Right.
So there's that. But then in general, I also think that exclamation points are super specific to the voice of the writer. And here's what I mean. Like Ryan North's Dinosaur Comics T-Rex is inherently the chipperest, most optimistic dude in the world. And so I'm not looking at one right now, but I'm guessing that if you were to flip to any dinosaur comics, every second sentence, if not every sentence from T-Rex, is an exclamation point, because that character looks at the world of like, oh, shit, Brad, we're out in the world. We're doing things. Whoa, life is great. I'm T-Rex.
Yeah, anything can be an exclamation coming from him. Oh, look at this. It's a tuna fish sandwich.
Right, exactly. And that's part of the joy of that character, is that he is joy-filled on most everything. And then there's also a whole genre of child comics like James Cachalco, or I don't know. I'm trying to think of other ones where the exclamation point is super widely used. Now, having said that, no matter how much social media or texting influences us, if I see a lot of exclamation points in a Chris Ware comic, I know something's wrong, because those comics don't feel an ounce of joy. And so why would they have an exclamation point in it? You know what I mean? Like, there's a mood for
somebody screwed up.
Yeah, something is seriously wrong if there's an ounce of joy there. So the mood of,
excuse me, Chris, you got some joy in your comic. You might want to do something about
that. Listen, you're going to want to make this bleaker again. Remember that the human existence is only pain. So remember that if you could just put more ash and woe in here, that would be great. If you could just sprinkle some more of that in here. Could we maybe get some gnashing of teeth? That would also be good. Right. And some ennui. Yeah, that would be wonderful. Okay. So what I'm getting at is
that like ennui? Wait a minute. Is that like Amway? Is the ennui?
Were you meaning to say? Oh, I deserve it.
Did you mean ennui? You sound like an amateur when you say something like ennui.
This I have been so hoisted on my own petard here, Brad. You have been waiting for this for months, for years.
Oh, and you tried to run right past it, but I tackled you and dragged you right to the ground. I am bringing this podcast to a screeching halt.
Oh, God.
Ennui.
That's amazing.
Oh, man.
Well, you've been waiting for it, friends. And now we've finally gotten to it. Dave mispronounces the French word. Oh, we've gotten to it. It took us over a year, but Dave did it. And Brad was here to catch it. Brad, tell everybody
That's
what
right.
Dave's won.
Dave's won a week full of seeing the hashtag small man repeated over and over and over in his Twitter feed. Remember that small man on way.
You jerk. Ooh, now I'm going to see that hashtag.
Thank goodness. We're all going to see it. So before I interrupted you, yes. If you saw triple exclamations in a Chris Ware comic or in somebody that was doing something with a lot of gravitas, then certainly you'd feel that was out of place, right?
Yeah, no, so what I'm getting at there is, by the way, I will never be one-tenth the cartoonist that Chris Ware is, so take that with a grain of salt.
No, no, you are really not.
What a joke! What I'm saying here is that there is a mood and a tone to every comic, and so the exclamation point that is super appropriate to one is really weird and wonky and shoehorned in on another comic. So...
Yeah.
Irrespective of, boy, that took a minute to get out.
Now I've got you on. I got you.
Brad,
nervous.
There's like a flop sweat on my back now, and I'm so nervous about saying words. I was like, how do I say irrespective? Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, Brad's watching me. Oh, God. So anyway, irrespective of what social media is doing or what texting is, God bless America, of what texting is doing or social media is doing, your writing will have a mood and a tone. And if you feel like an exclamation point is warranted on every sentence, then maybe that is the tone you want to strike. But if you're finding that people are like, all right, you know, he picked up a loaf of bread, he doesn't need to be excited about that, then that's your sign to tone it down. What do you think, Brad? Any last thoughts on that one, or have we put that one to bed?
I actually do. I actually do.
All right.
This is one I'm fascinated. I'm actually fascinated about this. So as long as we're talking about this now, you've got a character who's saying, expressing a very excited disbelief, and you're in a situation where you've got to combine a question mark and an exclamation point. But the question becomes, is it question mark exclamation or exclamation, question mark. And before you even bring up Interrobang, that's a nonsense mark that nobody understands, nobody uses. Do not talk to me about Interrobang. Go home and tell your mother she raised an idiot. Is it question exclamation or exclamation question?
Oh, are you asking me? Because I actually have opinions on this. Holy shit. I didn't think I would have opinions on this.
At some point, I was going to run out of breath. And you're going to have to talk.
I'm just genuinely surprised that I do have an opinion about this. All right. So for me, a question mark exclamation point. By the way, I would absolutely use both of these and have used both of these in the past. So if you're about to say that I'm a dummy, then fine. I'll take it. I have used both of these. So first one, question mark with an exclamation point is predominantly a question that also is tinged with surprise. So that's that one for me,
yes.
Right? For me, the exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point is huge surprise that also has a tiny hesitation of a question inside of it, right? So both of those have a different mood. And yes, I've used both of those. And if you're going to hate on me, then fine. Haters going to hate, Brad. Haters going to hate.
We are brothers from different mothers today. I use exactly the same yardstick as to.
By the way, never have we sounded older than me saying haters gonna hate, and then you saying brothers from another mother right after. That's just two grandpas on a park bench going, well, haters gonna hate. I'm Brad Geiger. We're mother and brothers from another mother.
2 80-year-olds that heard a Run DMC record back in 1986.
Yeah. And they just got done talking about their prostate exam, and now they're talking, well, haters gonna hate.
Word to your mother. But I use the same yardstick. In other words, if it's more of a question, then the question mark comes first. And if it's more surprise, then or if it's more forceful, then question, then the exclamation mark comes first.
Yeah. So I think I was just genuinely surprised that I had an opinion on that when you brought that up. I was like, what? Wait, I do have thoughts.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Yeah. And have you ever heard somebody try to push an Interrobang on you?
So here's the thing. Interrobangs barely work even when they're printed, when they're done as a printed font. Right. Even then, most people are like, what the hell is this?
That's my point.
What is this printing error? Right.
Exactly.
But if you try to do an Interrobang with hand lettering, you look like you've had a stroke. Like it never looks good. Don't use an Interrobang. It was a weird idea from 1880. Don't use an Interrobang. Maybe it wasn't 1880. I don't know. But it didn't work even when they came up with it. So don't use it.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, you know what, though? Now that I'm thinking about it, we could do a whole podcast, honest to God, you and I, and it would be so boring, talking about the varying points of whether you should use an ellipses, .. whether you should use a comma, or whether you should use an / in comics. Like, that could be a whole boring, but really for us, fun topic to talk about for half an hour.
Yep. and whether you should divide them into separate word balloons if you're using dashes and commas and ellipses. There's a whole strategy to all of that. And you're right. It would be the boringest podcast that nobody ever listened to, but you and I would be fascinated.
Yeah, exactly. That's the accounting equivalent of us going, and then you carry the two and bring forward the percentage of the... Anyway. All right, Brad, we got one last question to end off the show. This will be a nice long one for this week. Why don't we do one more, my friend? What do you think? Can I throw it at you?
Okay, go right ahead.
Right. This question goes out specifically to both of us. So, yeah. Brad and Dave, I thought that would get a laugh out of you. Nothing. All right.
I don't know which one you're going to, because I think we skipped one, but go ahead.
Oh, did we skip one? All right. Well, then I'm doing my best, Brad. I'm keeping it together. All right. So, Brad and Dave, what best practices would you recommend when including embedded ads in your comic, like for your Kickstarter, your Patreon, etc.? So, Brad Geiger, I have done this in the past. First, let's just ask a generalized question. Have you ever embedded any ad below your comic?
No. The short answer is, to a significant degree, I have not. I might have included like a line of type or something like that, but never anything that raises to the level of what you're about to talk about. So no, I don't have a lot of experience.
Okay. Well, now before I dive into why and how I do it, I actually do want to explore why you haven't. Do you find that it demeans the image of the comic to have an ad below it, or that it pulls eye focus, or that it changes the enjoyment of the comic to have an ad there? And by the way, all those are fair.
Not at all.
If that's your reaction.
No, not at all. I just, I don't have a good answer for why I haven't done it. I'm not against it. I know that it exists. It's just an avenue that I've never used.
Well, okay. That's kind of a fair answer.
Well, I'm not lying to you. It's something that I've never done.
I like how the question is like, now, Brad, why have you never ridden a bike? Are you afraid of riding a bike? Is it hard for you? Well, Dave, the answer is I've never ridden a bike. Well, Brad, no, that wasn't the question. Well, I've never done it. And just a tumbleweed blows past. I'm like, well, that's not what I was asking you. All right. So Brad has not done it. That's actually totally fair. Like, never having attempted it is in itself a stage in this process. So that's fine. So I will talk about me doing it. And I will admit, first of all, that the first time I did it, and every once in a while, occasionally, I will feel a twinge of weirdness in having an ad underneath my comic. Especially the first time, but I got over it very quickly because it works, I found. So let me talk to you about how I do it and why I do it. So my comic, when I generate the JPEG or the PNG file that is going to go up on the web, the final image, that individual image is going to go out on my RSS feed. It's going to go out in the emails that I send. It's going to be tweeted. Mm-hmm. It's going to go on Instagram. It's going to go on Reddit. It's going to go on a whole variety of spots that you and I all use together, right? But in all of those places, it is slightly different because of formatting, because of the overall medium constraints. But the image itself, for the most part, is the one constant. Some of them I get to associate a blog with it. Some of them I get to have a little bit of text with the tweet or a little bit of a caption with the Instagram, right? So sometimes you can do it. And sometimes you can even include a link, although not on Instagram, unless you do it in your story and you have 10,000 followers. What I'm getting at is the one constant is the image itself, which is why I do the ad in the comic. And in so doing, you're immediately upping the awareness of the thing that you're promoting that week or that month in a way that your various blog posts and tweets might not get to people with. The comic is the one constant that everyone ideally is going to see. Some people might not see your tweets. Some people might not see your Instagram captions. Some people might not see your blog posts, but they're all going to see the comic, ideally. So put the ad underneath it was my thinking.
Yeah.
Now, does it work? Here's the honest to God truth. I have no concrete metrics that I can throw at you to say that it works. All I know is it puts the awareness one step higher for people that I do have a Kickstarter going on. I do have a Patreon. I do have a new book for sale, whatever it is. To Brad's much earlier point and the widely held assumption that you have to see an ad 7 times before you take action on it, this at least gets it in front of them one more time.
Yeah, at least one more time, because you're going to be doing several comics during the course of this campaign.
Exactly. Now, let me tell you one other thing that I have made the mistake of in the past, and that is the visual weight of the ad, I think at most, can be 2/3 the visual weight of your comic. Otherwise, if it's equivalent or larger than the comic, then really it's an ad that's being joined by a comic, not a comic being joined by an ad.
Right.
And you want the comic to always have priority. You are fundamentally and foremost a cartoonist and an entertainer. Do that first. And then as a bonus, very rarely you can throw an ad in. It just has to be smaller. It has to be 2/3 size, 1/2 size, 1/3 size as a little addendum below the comic. And so that's the way I do it. Brad, now that you've seen some of the times that I've done. Oh, and then one last thing I should mention before we move on. Then once the event is over, either the Patreon push or the book sale is over or the Kickstarter is over, I always go back in my archives and delete the ad from that image and re-upload the
image. Yes.
That's a key part. Because
I was wondering.
You don't want it to linger. It was there for a purpose. The purpose is over. Now get rid of the ad. Make it just a normal comic in the archives. So Brad, now having said all of that, what are your thoughts on the way that I do it? Bad, good?
I've got a lot of thoughts. I've got a lot of thoughts. Number one, I want to underline that you're saying put it below your comic, not above your comic.
Yep.
Because obviously, if you put it above it, it's going to be read as the comic and your comic is going to be secondary. So I like that. A few things. Number one, let's say Sheldon, it's typically like a 4-panel, a 3 or 4-panel strip. Have you ever thought about doing it as a additional panel at the end of the strip in the same way that I see you doing an additional panel at the end of a Instagram swipe comic? Where you swipe, 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 you get to the punchline, there's one more swipe, you swipe, and then there's the ad there. Have you ever experimented with that in your comic itself?
Well, no, but in a way, because I have this ad below the comic that is two-thirds or half size of the comic, it's kind of like a final panel. It's in the sense mm-hmm. that it's another visual block for your eye to scan over once you've read the final panel. But
right.
I mean, I guess I see what you're meaning. Like, if I do a tall vertical comic and there's four panels with Sheldon and another character talking, and then there's a fifth panel that's equally sized, is that what you're saying?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, so I guess it just would be a continuation and a scroll. I mean, yeah, I guess, okay, the short version is yes, I could see value in doing it that way. That could be a possibility, yep. Okay, so that's mm-hmm. one of your reactions. Keep them coming. This is good.
Now, I'm going to go back to Instagram because I know when you do the swipe, you know, multiple panel swipe comics, you often put a Sheldon at the end. And something that I've always wondered, and I don't even know if you'd have metrics on this, does that start to get people to stop swiping when they see they're getting near the end? So because they know the ad is coming and they're like, I don't want to see that ad. And they stop a little bit early.
Oh.
And if so, what are some ways that you could compensate for
wow,
that.
Brad, talk about a thought that I've never had. You're saying I'm training them to ignore the last panel so that after reading 30
yeah.
or 40 comics, they know just not to go to my last panel. Is that what you're, that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And you probably are right about that. I have never thought about that. Brad Geiger, once again, showing me all the things I'm doing wrong with my career.
Because I'm going to throw this back in. Going back to Chris Halbeck, who we've talked about or at the top of the show, I started to notice him doing something with his comics that he puts out on Instagram. And a lot of times he'll combine two strips and put the ad in the middle. So you'll go swipe, 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 punchline ad, and you'll see at the bottom with the dots that you're only halfway through and you're like, oh, there's more to come. And then you swipe again and now you're on a second strip.
Yeah, no, I listen, as is always the case when we talk about Chris, I think he's doing Instagram incredibly well, and there's a lot we could learn from him. And so I think that there is
yeah.
truth to that idea of his, where he combines two, usually they're similarly themed, wouldn't you say that's the way he does it? Is that they're,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
if
absolutely.
One is about milkshakes, yeah. then the second one is usually about milk or shakes or milkshakes or something like that, you know? Sorry, that was a terrible example. I don't know.
If one's about milkshakes, the other one's about milk or shaking or
God damn it.
Dementia. Or
let's not call me
Parkinson's.
The man about that. That was a bad one. All right, that was a bad example.
Try that one
Boy,
again,
I'm,
but with something.
I'm really getting what my just desserts in this show for a lot of the abuse that I have given in the and but all of it is absolutely just. Brad, you have every right to tear me apart. I'm stumbling over words. I'm speaking French wrong. I'm giving bad examples with milk and milkshake or milk that's being shaked. It's just.
Holy moly. Hashtag small man.
Oh, boy. Anyway, yeah, so that's an idea. And then I think also with Instagram, once you can get it up to, and I know this sounds like it's like, well, once you have $1 million, then you have $1 million. But once you get it up to 10,000 followers, you can also start putting swipeable ads in your story.
Yeah.
And that was a key one that I wanted to get to. Because once you get to that, then you mm-hmm. can start to genuinely redirect people without any typing off of Instagram to your Kickstarter or to your Patreon or all that. So anyway, I am pro advertising in the sense that a lot of these social media platforms, a kind of quiet agreement is you're getting all this stuff for free. And in exchange, I'm going to show you this one thing that shows how you could support me conceivably as an artist. And
right.
99% of the people go, great, sure, I'm enjoying this Instagram for free. Bye. But the 1% might support my Kickstarter, might support my Patreon, might buy a book, might do all that sort of stuff. So I have to have some way of reliably letting them know. But to your point, maybe I start taking that last panel off of every third comic so that you fool with their Pavlovian learning, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's been on my mind a lot as I'm doing more and more Instagram is how to compensate for that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, and this would be a good way to go out. What would make you consider or try putting a ad in your comic, or do you think you never will?
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not against it. My next Kickstarter, I probably will.
Okay. Okay. So it's just a matter of, it's like me. It's one of those lists of your to-dos that you've just never done. That's fair.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, we can't climb every mountain at once in the world. You have to pick your Himalayan mountain and start working up that one and then get to the next one. So that's fine. I get it.
And like I said, if I went back and look, I probably added like a line of type that was a different font and a color that stood out and stuff like that. I've never done what I would consider a full ad, but I've done maybe a little line of promotion or something underneath. So I've gone towards that, but I just haven't done it, but I'm not against it. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, and I do think, too, in general, that the notice should be put on every attempt at advertising that you do for a Patreon or a Kickstarter or a new book or a new Comic-Con appearance, that the vast, and this is kind of the little dirty secret that the advertising industry doesn't want you to know, the vast majority of advertising doesn't work. It's either through poor execution or perfectly fine execution, but nobody gives a shit. Most advertising is not going to work. So you just have to go in knowing that you're really only going to capture one, maybe two. And in a blue sky world, maybe 3% of people will care or click through or act on it. And the vast majority won't. But that's also true for a lot of what we do as a career. And so it's kind of in for a penny, in for a pound in terms of people supporting, I would think. Wouldn't you say, Brad?
I couldn't agree with you more. And on that note, you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Streaky the Supercat, the editor of webcomics.com, and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend over there in Los Angeles, fighting the on-way, Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped, and cartoonist of Sheldon at SheldonComics.com and Drive at DriveComic.com.
Never going to live that down. The Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from the delightful Andy Creighton at www.theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that again. patreon.com/comiclab. #SmallMan.
Oh, God. Jesus.